out there in podcast land, and welcome to a very special episode of the Front Row Flashbacks, where we will have a discussion with content producer, acclaimed documentary filmmaker, magazine editor, and award-winning journalist David Wehner. David has written pieces for such reputable outlets as The Hollywood Reporter, Variety, LA Weekly, Entertainment Tonight, The Insider, Yahoo, AOL, Fandango, Famous Monsters in Filmland, and many more. He logged 13 years in the trenches at Entertainment Tonight as senior editor of ET Online. He was also executive editor, or editor-in-chief, of the iconic Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine from 2015 to 2016, earning the prestigious Rondo Hatton Award 2 years in a row for Best Classic Magazine. David is the director, writer, producer of In Search of Darkness, a critically acclaimed 4.5-hour documentary about 80s horror movies. Its follow-up, In Search of Darkness Part 2, and In Search of Tomorrow, a documentary about 80s sci-fi movies for Creator VC. He naturally gravitates to the retro nostalgia of the 70s, 80s, and decades of the past, and considers himself to be a nostalgia curator. I'm Jay Hoffman, co-host of Front Row Flashbacks, and along with me for this interview are my fellow co-host from the Front Row Flashbacks, Ryan Lutens and Aaron McCabe. Join us on this ride. David, welcome to the Front Row Flashbacks. We are beyond thrilled to be talking with you. How's everything going in your world during these pandemic days?
They're going pretty well. I can't complain, and I'm very fortunate to be able to not be able to complain. You know, I'm experiencing the hardships like everyone else to varying degrees, but luckily things are going smoothly enough where I can be in production and work on In Search of Tomorrow, and I cannot complain because I get to do that.
That's great. I'm all vaxxed up finally. I don't know. Ryan is. I don't know about Aaron. She's just staring at me coldly.
I have autoimmune issues, so I'm waiting for more data.
Gotcha.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah. Plus, I thought there were older, the older age ranges should have access to it before my lower risk age range for the time being.
Well, I'm halfway in between. I got my first and I've got my second in a week or so. And so I'm still masking up and I'm still socially distant and emotionally distant. I was that way before. So,
And that's Aaron's also waiting to see if we. Aaron's also waiting to see if we turn into zombies.
Yeah.
That's
well,
true.
Listen, the chip is an inhibitor, so you can't turn into a zombie.
That's true.
Unless they do the overall switch, you know, and then we all become mass army, you know. But
some of my, God love them, my conspiracy theory friends were like, the CDC has zombie preparedness on their website. And I'm like, yo, guys, they've had that since like 2010. Let me give you some history on the snarky humor of the Centers of Disease Control and a little show called The Walking Dead.
My thoughts on all that are, I got everything injected into me when I was in the Army, so what's one more?
Right.
You know, I'm a walking Petri dish.
Your nickname is Agent Orange, isn't it? No?
Thankfully, I was in well after that.
Yeah.
Well, we are super enthusiastic about your documentaries, In Search of Darkness, Parts 1, Part 2. And In Search of Tomorrow, which we're excited when that gets released, and to get your thoughts on our favorite decade of movies, the 80s. But first and foremost, we must ask you the Front Row mandatory question. And I have to say, this question is most definitely the hardest question we're going to ask you. And it usually is first responded with a fair amount of vitriol. But what is your favorite movie?
Oh, man, that's mean. Why'd you ask me that? That's uncool. You can't do that. Well, I am one of those people where I can't pick a single one. It's just, you know, the day, the genre, the era, the style, the filmmaker, the mood, you know, it all applies.
This guy sounds like a director or something.
I honestly don't have a favorite movie. I mean, if you name a genre, I could sort of give you like top threes, that kind of stuff like that. But Air Bud, you got it out of me, I admit.
Yes. Yes. Our friends at Beyond the Mouse are going to love this interview.
I was going to say it was between that and Ernest Scared Stupid, but you know, it depends on the day.
Yeah, I agree. I have like a rotating, I always say it's a rotating list of 20, but the reality is probably more like a rotating list of 200. So we feel your pain, and that's the normal response that you gave us.
Yeah, I mean, I comically sidestepped it, but the reality is I do not have a favorite movie. I have many. I mean, I went to film school. I studied film theory, film production. Does that make me more qualified or less qualified to have a favorite movie? No, but it means that I'm passionate about film, and it means that I can't pick one.
One of the things we have started to, especially in the Flashbacks podcast, I think, is really get into the technical aspects and the art of it. And so I think as we start, you've been obviously well-versed in all of the academia that goes into film, and you've gone to school for it. But once you start to appreciate all of the different aspects that go into bringing a movie together, I see how it becomes even more difficult to pick it, because in all of these different movies, you can pick out different aspects of some of the design, the costume design, the production design, the sound editing, the cinematography, where it makes it even more difficult. And you start to maybe see beauty in other films you didn't see before.
I had my freshman year, I went to Ithaca College Film School, and my freshman year I had a class called Introduction to Film Aesthetics and Analysis. And it was the first class and the first day. And the teacher, the professor, said, "You're either going to love me or hate me after this first day, because once you take this class, you will never be able to see film the same way again. Never again. You will never be able to just sit down and watch a film and be a detached audience. You're going to see like x-ray glasses more than you ever saw before. And you're probably going to be angry at me, you know, because you can't appreciate it the same way." And he was absolutely right. And in the many years since, in the many movies I've seen in my life, ever since that class and that first day, I've always had to sort of have a compartmentalized brain of just the audience who wants to be intrigued, entertained, and informed. And then there's the film student who's dissecting everything that's on screen. And sometimes they converge, and sometimes I annoy myself because I can't quite just sit back and enjoy.
That sounds like a lot of our conversations within our our podcast thread.
Yeah, a lot of arguments. I mean, debates.
But, you know, my husband does that. And before I would be, I'd be irritated by him, because we'd see a movie and he'd always ask me, "Well, what do you think?" And I'd, you know, say whatever I'd say. And then he'd be like, "Yeah, it was okay. I didn't think it was that good." And I'd like kind of be offended, because I'd always be like, "You never think anything's good." But he'd answer it in a way where he's like, "Was it entertaining? Was I entertained? Yes, I was entertained. But was it a good film? I don't think so." And I'm like, but now I see what people are talking about.
So it's, everyone has reasons for why they love things, you know. That's why film and film discussion, film Twitter, film social media, whatever you want to, you know, have as your platform to have conversations about film. We all come from different points of view, different walks of life, different predilections, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you can't say that a movie is great and a movie is not great based on a certain set of rules. You know, it is all opinion, and it's all, you know, there's certain objectivity about quality, but it's all subjective. And, you know, people like to be superior with their opinion, but it all comes down to you stand by your convictions.
I'm not going to make any comment on Nomadland after that.
I was just going to say something.
We're having a lot of arguments about Nomadland.
I'm right, you're wrong.
Listen, all you need to know is that wherever you go, you need to have different size buckets to shit in. And you're good to go.
Well, that, you're,
maybe
your
we
last...
need to invite him on Sunday.
We do. We need him. we need him on our side.
We're having a lot of arguments. Nomadland versus
anything.
Promising Young Woman.
Very different films. Very different films. Well, that... I like apples more than oranges. How about you?
Yeah.
Fair enough. I will say, though, your last comment does kind of bring us into kind of the first thing I wanted to ask you. You know, with you've been in the entertainment industry for some time, fair amount of experience, more than us. And a lot of it seems like you focused on the realm of horror and monsters. You know, obviously you're in Search of Darkness documentaries. In my opinion, I would call them omnibus guides to 1980s horror. Where did that appreciation come? We're talking opinions and our backgrounds. And where's your appreciation of all things horror stem from?
When I was a kid, I was a 70s kid. I was born in 68. And so I grew up on television and reruns and going to the movies and having a weekly movie theater where every week there was a new movie for 99 cents. It was the last, you know, before the trash heap. And on TV, a little black and white TV until my parents got a color TV for the den, which was a special occasion. I watched everything. I was a TV junkie. And I fell in love with monster movies, first and foremost. And I also loved everything from Star Trek to Planet of the Apes to Space 1999 to Godzilla to Dracula, Frankenstein, classic Universal monsters, Roger Corman B-movies, Wasp Woman, you know, the Mole People, all that stuff. And I found Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine because it was on the newsstand. And it happened to coincide with me seeing a big screen revival screening of The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. And I was already passionate about Ray Harryhausen and his stop motion animation creatures, seeing, you know, It Came from Beneath the Sea and Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Well, now I was obsessed with the Cyclops, and there he was on the cover of Famous Monsters magazine. And that just validated that this was for me. And I've always been a fan of that stuff ever since. And as I got older, I evolved to, you know, John Carpenter's Halloween kind of was the graduate level course for a monster kid, where all of a sudden, holy shit, you know. you know, prior to that, I had seen The Exorcist on television. I'd seen the Amityville Horror on television. Scared the crap out of me, one. Scared the crap out of me, two. Then I saw Halloween, scared the crap out of me, three. But unlike other people who don't like the horror genre because it makes them feel insecure and unsafe, I was obsessed with deconstructing these films and understanding why they scared me and challenging myself to see them again and not be scared, which meant that I needed to understand what happened next and why and sort of study it. Now, this is prior to me going to film school, and I would not even deign to say that I was deconstructing it from a film point of view. But as a tweenager, I was still trying to figure out the next move so I wouldn't be scared. So I'd be like, okay, the music gets loud here. The music is getting louder here, and there's going to be a jump scare, but it's not going to be the kill yet. All right, I got it. I'm figuring this out. I'm figuring out the tropes. I'm figuring out how it's all laid out. So that's a long way of saying that the foundation was there ever since I was a kid with an extremely active imagination and lots of freedom to play with friends and outside and encouragement from my parents.
Yeah, I grew up myself. I grew up in a horror household, and it was always around. And then it's trying to sneak the, you know, HBO recorded VHS that we have, yep. You know, we're not supposed to. And, you know, we just recorded our full disclosure on Godzilla versus Kong, and really we all went into like our history with Godzilla, and
oh yeah,
and it sounds like we all have a very similar why horror. As
I need to add that I grew up in New York, just outside of New York City, and in that area they had a couple of things on television that were absolute staples. That was like my informal film school, watching the 4:30 movie in the afternoon, weekdays. They would have Monster Week. They'd have Edgar Allan Poe Week. They'd have Vincent Price Week. They'd have, you know, Godzilla Week. all that stuff. I mean, that's where I first saw, you know, Godzilla versus, you know, King Kong versus Godzilla, 1962 version, and every Gamera movie, which I watched completely unironically as not funny. And, you know, I loved that stuff growing up. You know, they had Schiller Theater on, I want to say, Saturday night, you know, scared the crap out of me. And I was just raised on all this stuff. And so it's just completely normal to me. I just have to add, we didn't have HBO. We didn't have cable. So I had very strategic friends where they were the ones who had cable. I'd check the TV guide to see, you know, oh, Friday the 13th is playing. I think I'll have a sleepover with my friend Sergio, and we'll get up at 2 a.m. and watch Friday the 13th. Because that's
good
the way
old
I'm
TV
gonna be able
guide.
To see it, you know?
Yeah. I don't know if you boys remember the TV guide.
Yeah, so you can call it the dated. This you can call this the dated reference hour if you want.
Well, these two are a little younger than me, so some of the they give me a lot of crap because there are definitely, especially in film, there are like gaps where I'm like, "Yep, I was right in the middle of that," and they're like, "We were still in, you know, we were still in kindergarten or something like that." So don't worry, David. I remember a lot of the things that you do. I was born in 1982, so I was telling them on our thread when this documentary was presented for us to interview you and to watch. I was like, the first hour, I was texting them like, I could cry because this feels like my childhood to a T, like every movie that was outlined in Search of Darkness, and talking about going and getting your movies from the video store on Fridays and picking them out, which for me, when I was 5 years old, was War of the Worlds.
Yeah.
And so the original, and I remember that. I resonate with that deeply of being five and putting this movie on, but also hiding around the wall and peeking out when I knew the aliens were going to come out and seeing if I could get myself to be brave enough to actually watch it.
I know exactly what that's about. Yes.
Yeah. So speaking of your omnibus and your guide that you've provided for all of us, you don't just give viewers a list of movies, but you actually dive into the subgenres of horror, which I just adored, to actually have you delineate each different subgenre. And you've got horror, you've got heavy metal, you've got the slasher films. What's your favorite subgenre within horror? And with that, are there any subgenres that, like, you know, we talk about horror always pushing the limit and pushing the line. Are there any subgenres for you that crosses your line or that you're not into? Like, for me, I grew up watching a majority of these movies, but as I got older, horror became more difficult for me to view. And like one of the subgenres that's completely off is pretty much like torture porn or anything that Eli Roth does. Yeah. I can't do Green Inferno, anything like that. What about you?
I'm with you. I when it's excessively gory, there's a certain factor that goes back to like when, you know, Maniac came out, and I read all about that in Fangoria magazine, and I was obsessed with how it was done and how Tom Savini made this look so realistic. But I was afraid to watch that movie. I thought that was going to be too much. And I was too young when that first came out to see it. And it took me a very long time to get around to it, because sometimes you build these things up in your mind to be more intense than you think than they really are. But sometimes they are worse than you expected them. You know, I mean, like the sort of cannibal Holocaust and a lot of the Italian stuff, a lot of Italian horror goes way over the top. You know, this eye and eyeball trauma, you know, it's just, it's heavy stuff and it's very realistic. And, you know, hand in hand with that, body horror, you know, the sort of the Cronenberg school of filmmaking, an unconditional, I don't know, a relationship with that that's a little uneasy is all I could say. You know, some of this stuff I think is great. I mean, one of his movies that I think is my all-time favorite film is a movie called Existence, It's not an 80s film, but it's a great film. But I think why I connect with it, other than the weird organic body horror in that, is that it's much like, I'm getting a moment here, the Christopher Nolan movie. What's the movie with
Memento?
The one, we all know it. I'm just having a late night.
Inception.
You know, it's very much Inception in that it plays with your sense of reality and where you are and if it's there or not. I would say, you know, American Werewolf in London is one of my all-time favorite movies. And, you know, maybe that's when animals attack. I don't know. You know, but that's, you know, nature run amok, you know, lycanthropies run amok. But, you know, it's a sort of like, or lycanthrope. But it's like, again, you're asking me what's my favorite movie, you know, what's my favorite subgenre. I think there are different examples that I love more than others. But when it comes to super hardcore gore, I usually kind of dodge that.
See, how about that's you guys? That's where I jump in. I'm all for the blood and guts. I mean, Cabin in the Woods, that whole scene where the elevators open up, I was like, yes, let it flow.
Yeah.
So, but In Search of Darkness is clearly a labor of love, and thank you so much for giving us that labor of love. Horror fans everywhere need to see this movie. The whole thing just oozes excitement, and it feels that way for all 4.5 hours a piece. Both of these films are 4.5. So I mean, I just, my question is what inspired you to make two in-depth documentaries about 80s horror?
Well, it all started with, first of all, just one. And it all came from an opportunity that was given to me by Robin Block, who's the executive producer of these movies. He found me through a friend and we were introduced, and I knew that he was making this, an 80s movie that would tackle a decade, year by year, movie by movie. And, you know, long story short, he recruited me to write and direct this for him. And I realized very quickly, while he was calling it the definitive, you know, film of 80s horror, I realized that there's no way that that's possible. There's no way that you can go movie by movie, year by year, and not have it be like hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. So I was very excited with the challenge. I was very excited with the opportunity. I had to make very difficult decisions about what to cover and what not to cover, knowing that there's so much out there. Because I'm a total completist. I mean, I, you know, everyone watches In Search of Darkness and they say, this is great. Oh, wait, I see all these posters for these movies that aren't in the movie. What's the deal? That's my favorite. And why aren't they covering it? That's my way of telling the audience, I know they're out there. I know they exist. Perhaps one day we'll get to them. But this is what we're going to cover. And so I made a very difficult decision to sort of cover, for the most part, North American horror and not international horror. I definitely leaned into the heavy hitters and a lot of the sequels. I did pick a variety of more eclectic choices. But in the back of my mind, I hope one day I could do more. Whenever I sat down for an interview, I didn't sit down for like 20 minutes or a half hour. I got an hour, sometimes 2 hours, sometimes 3 hours with everyone I talked to. So I had a wealth of material that I would hope one day I would be able to continue the story in some way, shape, or form. And the response to In Search of Darkness was so positive. Robin said, let's go and make a part two. And I said, great. Can I make it another 4.5 hours? And he's like, well, this one's going to be more like 2, 2.5, maybe 3. I'm like, okay, sure. And of course, I went ahead and I made a 4.5 hour movie.
Yes. Yeah.
And which he's all for. And he's very happy that I did. But that was, I've been very, very fortunate that he has given me a lot of trust to kind of give me a blank canvas, knowing that I love this stuff so much that I get to kind of do it the way I want to do it. And pick the things that I want. And the biggest challenge is getting as many people as we can to talk about these movies within our indie budget and time frame to cut this thing and put it together. And of course, part two, we had the challenge of COVID came, you know, right when we were ready to start. So And ultimately, I'm very proud of what we did with In Search of Darkness Part 2. You know, we got 15 brand new faces. I did 23 new interviews on top of all the material and individuals from the first one that carried over selectively. But I would have loved to get more, but it just wasn't possible. But I think the response to In Search of Darkness Part 2 has been so wonderful, and it's about to be on Shudder on the 26th. So even more people are going to get to see it. I honestly and genuinely did not expect so many people to say, "This is great. Let's see part three. Can't wait." And so Robin said, "We're doing part three. Are you in?" So that's next.
Yes. I mean, you really scoured through more horror than I can dream of. And I consider myself a huge horror fan. I actually told Jay about In Search of Darkness, I believe. And then I found out they were doing part two. And I looked and saw that it was $60. I'm like, all right, how do I convince my wife that I can spend $60 on a movie? Still haven't convinced her yet, but with it coming on Shudder, I'm super excited. But you know, you really went through the gamut with all these movies. You scoured through so much horror, things that I, you know, didn't know were out there. But of all these movies that you went through, what 80s horror movie doesn't get the appreciation that it deserves?
Sorry. Did you hear that little ding? That was me coming up with an idea.
That's right.
In Search of Darkness 4?
Yes.
Exactly. Sorry, you're catching me while I'm also multitasking with production. So hang on 2 seconds. My apologies. Okay. The movie that does not get enough love is most underappreciated. That is a very difficult one to answer. I'm going to say Evil Speak. Ron Howard's brother in Evil Speak. It's a weird movie. It's a military boarding school. Clint Howard stars. He's a bullied kid who gets his revenge through the help of a computer and Satan. And it's such a ridiculous premise because they're trying to capitalize on, you know, home computers and nerds getting their comeuppance. And there's something about it that is just, it's sort of drafting on the sort of carry telekinetic powers with a little, you know, satanic panic and a little boarding school drama taps while you're at it. It's a wonderful hybrid that I think no one talks about enough. And is it a perfect film? No, but I'm always entertained and will always watch it whenever I could find it, which is next to never.
I literally just looked it up on Amazon.
Well, okay. So speaking of your movie that you don't think gets enough appreciation, one of the things I've kind of noticed, you speak about it in the In Search of Darkness, the first one. I don't know if you touch on it yet on In Search of Darkness Part 2, but one of the things we see in the 80s is all of the prolific creation of original storytelling. And I feel like as we've kind of moved into, and not that I'm totally on top of the pulse of horror like Ryan is nowadays, but it feels like there's a lot of remakes. And so my question for you about that is, I don't usually watch the remakes because I'm kind of a purist in the sense of I like the way the originals were. So it really has to take something for me to dive into a remake. So I did see the Halloween remake when that came, or Rob Zombie's Halloween. I don't even think I've seen the 2018 version of Halloween because I just love the original.
You're making a mistake.
Am I? Okay.
Yes.
I'm willing to rectify that. But you know, we've got remakes of Halloween. We've got remakes of Fright Night. We've got remakes of The Thing. Is there a remake that you suggest as Ryan is doing, or is there a remake that you high as, or I'm sorry, hold as in high of a regard as the original, or what's your opinion on remakes?
When it comes to remakes, I think a lot of the remakes in the 80s are wonderful. Mm-hmm. And you did mention The Thing. You know, a lot of people, when The Thing came out, and we touch on this a little bit in Search of Darkness, especially Siskel and Ebert. It's one of my favorite little moments when, Ebert called The Thing the barf bag movie of the summer.
Oh, it's hilarious.
And Siskel, his eyes go wide like, what? Are you serious? This is a great film. But I understand that because he's coming from a guy who just, a couple decades earlier saw as a kid, the Howard Hawks produced version of The Thing from Another World and thought it was wonderful. And here comes John Carpenter and Rob Bottin adding blood and guts and gore. And he's just like, this is a mess and this is awful and you don't need any of this stuff. So, all remakes carry the baggage of the original, and some the original can definitely be improved on and creates a great story, great idea, great structure, great something. But sometimes it's just not enough, and you can have a great remake. I think the Blob remake is great, and of course The Fly, Cronenberg, is just it's excellence, absolute excellence. But in terms of like more recent stuff, you did mention the Fright Night one. Fright Night is one of my all-time favorite movies. I just love it, Tom Holland's Fright Night, and I just think the remake was solid, but it's just not necessary for me. But I'm not someone who goes around and says all remakes, Hollywood has no original ideas. You can't have a remake. Don't do it. It's usually the case that it's not so good, and I usually avoid it. I didn't see the Child's Play remake. I didn't see the Poltergeist remake. I didn't see the Fog remake. All these, I was happy the first time around with all of these movies, so I didn't go see them. And I beg to differ with you on the Halloween remake. I did see it out of curiosity, but I love the Carpenter, original so much that the Rob Zombie version to me was just, it just wasn't my cup of tea, but even like the Nightmare on Elm Street remake, I just thought that was, a pale in comparison. But it doesn't mean that there aren't really good things that do come out there. What can I say? Apparently the Evil Dead remake is quite good and everybody loves that. But I love Evil Dead so much. And even though everyone said it was great, I'm fine with the original. Maybe I'm getting a little get off my lawn here, but I'm fine with the originals more often than not. And if there's overwhelming praise for a remake, I might check it out, but to each their own, because I think if you say all remakes are unnecessary, you wouldn't have The Thing. You wouldn't have that The Fly. You wouldn't have The Blob. You wouldn't have some of these things that you really like. You wouldn't have that Halloween remake that you really like, It's of value to you. So, we want more original ideas. But when remakes come along, here's the thing. If they're great, people like them. And if they're not great, then it never does any harm to the original, does it?
No.
That's a very good point.
Solid.
Oh, it's the internet again. You and your darn internet, Ryan. While he's freezing up, I'll throw something. Here's a remake. The Elijah Wood version of Maniac. Really good. Really
well, fun. A lot less blood and guts. One thing that remake does offer to me is one of the best soundtracks that I've heard in quite some time. I listened to that soundtrack over and over and over. I like Elijah Wood. I think he did a great job. That movie itself, I didn't respond to. I didn't think it was very good. But, I like the soundtrack. I listened to it over and over and over. When I was working with Weary Pines on the soundtrack for In Search of Darkness, part one and two, I used that Maniac soundtrack saying this is something that I love, and I'd love for things that sound in the neighborhood of some of these tracks, which also owe a lot to Giorgio Moroder, who did a lot of amazing soundtracks, including the Cat People soundtrack and so on back in the early 80s and late 70s, like his Midnight Express soundtrack is insane, really good. early techno and synthesizers. Great stuff.
All right. Is my internet, as my internet is trying to become sentient. So we're talking about 80s and remakes. Is there a movie from the 80s that has not gotten the remake treatment that you would like to see remade?
Evil Speak. No.
I was going to say that too. I should have. Why didn't I? As long as Clint Howard's in it, because he's a national treasure.
What could get a good remake? Let me put my thinking cap on that one for a minute.
I didn't say good, because most remakes.
What did you think of, what did you think of the remake of It?
I like part one.
Yeah.
For the most part. I for some reason, it's really weird because I was very much looking forward to part two. And I was quite disappointed by part two, but I really enjoyed part one. And I love Stephen King, and you know, maybe we need a Maximum Overdrive remake.
Can you direct this one too?
Yeah,
exactly.
I will take a 4-hour soundtrack. Maximum Overdrive.
Yeah,
I can just imagine the soundtrack.
But yeah, I thought it was good. I enjoyed it. Now it arguably is not a remake. You know, when you're sometimes the source material, it's a hard argument to make sometimes. To sort of stick to your convictions when there are different factors at play. You know, like it you could say is a remake of the TV movie, but the TV movie was an adaptation of the book. And so this is an adaptation of the book as well. You know, I mean, when the Shining was an adaptation of the book, but not as much, and Stephen King hated it. And then they did the Mick Garris TV miniseries, which was much closer to the book. Was that a remake of the movie? No, that was just yet another adaptation. You know, when you're going based on a book or a play or some sort of source, a lot of these aren't necessarily remakes. William Friedkin loves to say that, you know, he did a remake of The Wages of Fear called Sorcerer, a great movie if you've never seen it. And it has nothing to do with the supernatural. It's a thriller with Roy Scheider. But that is a remake of Wages of Fear, but he doesn't call it a remake. It's an update. And he likes to point out that, you know, when you see Hamlet on stage and then it's done again and then it's done again and it's done in the movies and it's done again, is it a remake of the movie? It's just another interpretation of the source material. Hmm. So there's a lot of ways to sort of look at these things. It's easy to just call things remakes.
I like that. Aaron.
Fine.
Man, know your It history. Jeez.
So all three of us, as you can probably tell, love horror. You obviously love horror. I'm a person that loves a good horror movie right before bed. Totally relaxes me, makes me feel at ease. This totally freaks my wife out. She can't remotely understand. She has the exact opposite reaction. Her heart's racing. She's up late. So my question is, what is it about the horror genre that draws some people in, like way in, and drives others away?
Oh, by the way, I think, you know, in terms of a remake, what's you know, ripe for a remake? I think the Chud series is ready to come back. You know, I think Chud is primed for a remake, and you can make a really cool thing out of that.
The world's ready.
The world is
ready for underground dwellers.
Yeah, exactly. And Bud the Chud, I mean, it's all there. You got a whole series rearing to go for a whole brand new audience. I love horror, but I don't always like to watch horror at night right before bed, because it does scare me sometimes. It does infect my dreams on a rare occasion. I mean, I can divide it from reality and fantasy and you know, people horror is cathartic for some people. It's an escape for other people. It's just an indulgence or entertainment or prurient for people. Everyone sees it differently. It does something for all of us for different reasons, but I think we all are fans, because there's a certain elevated intellectualism that you can understand that this is about, things that don't happen in real life or shouldn't happen in real life. And you can get a lot of your daily aggressions and curiosities and fantasies and what have you by watching all this stuff. You know, there's a lot of people who don't understand why that this is harmless to when they look at it at face value and see how bloody and awful and violent that it is. But I think fandom, for the most part, 99% of us can understand that it's something to be experienced and not take home with you. You know, you can admire the painting on the wall, but you don't take it out off the wall from the museum and take it home. You know, horror is the same way.
Fair.
So the In Search of Darkness documentaries, and I'm sure this In the Search of Tomorrow follows a similar trajectory. They act almost as an encyclopedia for horror, and with In Search of Tomorrow, the sci-fi genre. Where do you see these In Search of documentaries branching off to, or are they their own standalone thing? Do you maybe see like companion books or like a TV series as a possibility, much like we have with the history of horror and the history of sci-fi that AMC has done?
I think I don't see a TV series anytime soon. We're a very small company, Creator VC, that's Robin Block's company, and we keep it small, and we maintain a lot of creative freedom, complete creative freedom, because we get to do what we want. As soon as you get involved with you know, networks and streaming services, sometimes they want to, you know, add some cooks to the kitchen. You know, can definitely do companion book. I would never say that we wouldn't do a TV series where you do, you know, a year per episode. You know, you can do 10 hours. I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities. But I think what makes these projects unique is that what calls attention to it is that it's a 4.5-hour sit structured year by year. And rather than divide it into different categories of subgenres and stuff like that, you're really going through the decade year by year, movie by movie. And while it's not every movie, and you kind of can reset like I have with each new installment or chapter of In Search of Darkness, part one, part two, part three, however many we ultimately do. Where do I see it going? I think you can go to other decades. We're plotting to do In Search of Darkness 90s. You know, I mean, there's so many great movies and so many great decades. I'd love to do In Search of Darkness 70s, but I think the problem is the majority of the talent and the artists and the people who were there have ultimately aged out. You know, it's like if I want to sit down with Richard Donner and talk about The Omen, which I would love to do, and I have for Famous Monsters. You know, he's in his 90s now, and it's tough. It's definitely tough. The recollection isn't there. The health isn't there. The life might not be around anymore. But there are plenty of decades, plenty of subgenres, plenty of ways to tackle these things, plenty of genres. You know, there is In Search of the Last Action Heroes. There's In Search of Darkness. There's In Search of Tomorrow. We can go to fantasy. You could talk, you know, whatever the topic, you know, if there's an interest and a demand for it, we could do it. Robin is working on one for video games, In Search of Pixels. Mm. He has another documentary in the works now, called FPS, First Person Shooter, about the, you know, first person shooter video games and, the history of that stuff. And so, it's a format I think that is obviously very flexible, and you could tap into different fandoms and different sects that are interested in this kind of stuff.
I have a quick follow-up to that. Just something you said about going year to year, not doing the subgenres. I thought you did something interesting with it where you'd mention a subgenre, or you'd mention a music in the movies or kills in a movie. And it was so great because we mentioned the companion book, man, like, it's almost like a visual audio companion book itself, the way you did it. Like you said, each chapter was a decade, and then you have the little sidebar, here's about music. So was that an intentional way there or intentional way you filmed it and had that in mind before you did that?
Yeah, absolutely. From the very beginning, I just thought, well, it's a very cool concept to go from 1980 to 1989 movie by movie. It will get a little bit repetitive. Even though they're different movies and you go from movie to movie to movie, you really need to break it up with sort of a, like a, you know, a palate cleanser, so to speak. So I figured, and also I think when you're only going movie by movie, which is also really cool, you limit the scope of the conversation because it's more focused on that particular project. And I just know that there's so many things to talk about. So many, it's just everything from filmmaking to themes to just the overall context of all these movies in this decade, so many ways to tackle the subject. I figured chapters in between years was the best way to go about it. And the idea, you know, I was taken to task by some people when I would do like the pop culture and politics of the 80s, saying, you know, why didn't you go more about the politics? Why didn't you talk about more about the AIDS crisis? Why didn't you talk about more of X, Y, or Z? Why didn't you talk about the satanic panic? Why, you know, so many things. Why didn't you do that? And the thing is, it's all there. It's sort of a springboard. You know, if you are interested, you are welcome to find other great documentaries that are out there that have focused on these things. This is not that documentary. But if you're interested, you could find out more. And it's the same thing with everything that I cover. You know, you can't ever with 2 to 3 minutes or 4 minutes in a devoted to a movie, you just can't cover everything that that movie has to offer. It's just not there. There's so much more. You know, there's so many production stories, and you can go to these, you know, Screen Factory or you know, the DVD, the Blu-ray, and the special features. There's plenty of stuff out there if you want to know more. This movie can't be all of that, or we'd still be watching that first In Search of Darkness, you know, just keep going. So to me, I think it's a great opportunity to be exposed to stuff, to learn about things, to reinforce what you already know, to see people that you don't normally see talking about these movies. You know, that is what's fun to me about these, the structure of this. It's like, you know, have John Carpenter talk about anything else, you know, Joe Dante talking about, you know, why he loves Killer Clowns from Outer Space. You know, you don't get that anywhere else. You know, you have Joe Dante normally talking about The Howling or Gremlins, but, you know, if he just talks about other things and has other inspirations and, you know, motion picture marketing and how The Howling, you know, poster was different in the UK because they didn't want the screaming mouth, so they put a snout there, you know. That to me is interesting and fun, and you couldn't do that without these chapters in between.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if you can say this about many, but it's a very brisk 4.5 hour documentary. You know, it moves, it you look at the first time Ryan told me about it, I'm like, oh, I'm going to check that out. I'm like, oh, this is a multi-day viewing. And I'm pretty positive I just watched it in one sitting because it just, it breezes by, and the whole time you're like, "Oh, what's the next thing that we're going to talk about?" So
yeah, you get that dopamine, you know, as Alex Winter likes to say, you get that dopamine hit, you know. So
oh yeah,
everything, you know, just when you're like, "All right, after this one, I'm going to go to the bathroom, or I'm going to get up and get my popcorn," and then it's like, "Oh, wait, no, all right, one more, just one more," and they're all bite sized enough that it just keeps on, you know, keeps you riveted. And you know, all credit to my editor, Sam Way, who is just an absolute pro putting these things together and making them fly by and make it super interesting and polished. And, you know, he's very much a crucial element to making these movies so as enjoyable as they are.
Well, yeah, and I think also, sorry, Aaron, just the nostalgia too. You know, you're sitting here watching this documentary, and you're just reminiscing about the first time you watched all these movies that you discuss, and just the nostalgia just reigns over you. You just want to see what else you're gonna cover. It is a horror fan's dream.
And the film does such a great job of injecting enough of these little offshoots about, you know, what was going on with some of these movies politically, or what their messaging was, what they might have been allegories for, or for the stories behind the cover art and dealing with the whole artistic development of posters back in the 80s when that's what you did. The music, the special effects, you're right. It gives such an enriching behind the scenes and intimate view of all of these films that when to most people at first glance seem so superficial, and then it really invites you into the world. Like the secret world, the secret intelligent world of horror, of the horror genre,
yeah.
You know, because it kind of feels like people just look at it as this vapid, like, oh, they're just throwing blood and guts on the screen. And you realize, like, oh man, how deep some of these concepts really are. And one thing I really enjoyed was like how much of a curmudgeon John Carpenter is. I was telling my husband, I'm like, oh my gosh, John Carpenter was like, I didn't really want to remake The Thing, but the studio made me. I didn't want to remake. I didn't want to do Halloween 2. That was a mistake.
That's part of his, I think part of his charm, because that's kind of his MO, is that he's very self-effacing. You know,
yeah.
He's the horror master. He's a legend. We all know.
Amazing.
We all just know that. But he's a guy who spent a good portion following the success of Halloween, experiencing failure after failure after failure, or compromise after compromise after compromise. And he didn't. And what the work that he was able to achieve, from the behind the scenes standpoint, was always just not what necessarily what he wanted. You know, there are a few projects that he was very, very proud of beginning to end. You know, not saying that he was very disappointed with his career, but he just goes straight to the stuff that just didn't quite work, because he's a very grounded individual, you know? So to me, it's, you know, the most exciting stories that he had to tell were, you know, you know, the effort to turn Halloween into an anthology, you know, shows you how wrong I can be, you know.
And he was so about that.
But that, you know, I would have loved to have seen, you know, and Nick Castle echoes this, you know, how cool would it have been if every 2 years you got the new John Carpenter's Halloween : Season of the Witch : whatever, 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 whatever. You know, it'd be Creepshow, or every year you get something new, you know, every 2 years. But I would have loved to have seen Firestarter. You know, The Thing is an absolute, you know, stone cold masterpiece, but it was an absolute box office failure, and it cost him the job of doing Firestarter. You know, how cool would it have been if we got to see his Firestarter? But on the, you know, same side of the coin, I was so happy. Christine is one of my favorite films.
And
one of my favorite films of his. And I'm glad that he did that and got to do it. So, you know, in Big Trouble in Little China, you know, they got away with murder with that movie, because, you know, they turned the hero into the sidekick and the sidekick into the hero, and nobody knew until the movie came out, and everybody scratched their heads, but we all laughed and it was rollicking good time, you know. But I'm sure the Fox Brass were like, what just happened? They just made a whole movie and there's no hero. Wait, you know.
Kurt Russell's a total putz in this
movie. Yeah, Kurt Russell's a moron. They didn't promise that. He was supposed to be the chiseled hero. Just wait a minute. But we all love it, you know? It's great. It's funny as hell.
For sure. Well, speaking of some of those bigger studios, so you mentioned that Creator VC is a smaller film production and distribution company. And so in watching this and kind of just in looking at the evolution of film and studio systems and production and distribution companies over time, what do you think about the acquisition of smaller film production and companies and whatnot by like the major film studios? How has that impacted the horror genre? Because it seems one of the discussions that we often have and some of our other co-hosts talk about, you know, the bigger studios tending to be more risk averse and really driven mostly to ensure profit. And so horror seems to almost require the risks that you need in order to push the envelope. And we see this in these low budget, high creative yield projects in the 80s. What has that done for horror now? Do you see a difference? Do you feel like it's stagnated? And Or do you think the advancement of streaming services and platforms like Shudder or like Netflix that can independently fund some of these, I guess, riskier, quote unquote, projects, does it create an opportunity for a horror resurgence? What's your
opinion? Yeah, well, I think it's the latter that you mentioned. I think, Shudder is a great format, a great platform, a great streaming service that really knows its audience. And I'm not saying that just because they picked up In Search of Darkness Part 1 or 2, so they know what they're doing. But they have a lot of great material. But Netflix too. I mean, we're currently going through an absolute, arguably a renaissance for horror because so many great movies are coming out and it's a steady stream. You know, I would say Blumhouse has a lot to do with being the driving force and reinforcing force of that. But, you know, you could look at Warner Brothers too, you know, with like the Conjuring series, James Wan's stuff, Insidious, you know, all these movies are proving to be, you know, Annabelle, all those spinoffs, they're proving to be, horror always has shown itself to be a great return on a very small investment. And, it doesn't cost much to make a horror movie, and it always breaks even, if not makes a lot of money. And if they could diversify the platforms, you're great. If you have companies like A24 or 824?
Yeah, A24.
Doing Midsommar and Hereditary, movies like that. Colors Out of Space, all these movies, lots of great stuff. Lots of great stuff. There's a, I'm getting that moment again. Barbara Crampton has a new vampire movie. The something wife. Gosh, what is it?
Jacob's wife.
Jacob's wife. Sorry, Barbara. You're only talking about it on Twitter every single day. But movies like that. I think if anything, the quirkiness and the creativity and the building on the foundation of previous scares, and whether it's a remake or a brand new film or original idea, I think there's so much more now. I think we're going through a wonderful period right now where the diversification of the medium that you can distribute it in is only helping right now, because people are, while people like to see it on the big screen, we're living in a time, especially right now, if you want to be myopic, where people are just happy to have something with instant gratification. You know, they're happy to watch Kong versus, Godzilla versus Kong, on their home theater systems, because they don't want to go out in the theater right now. You know, is that going to kill theaters? I don't think so. I think once theaters, even though they're, the Cinerama Dome and Pacific Theaters and Arclight just closed down, someone's going to pick that stuff up. It's going to open back up again. It's all going to be normal again. I just think the way these, I'm sort of hitting a tangent now, but I think the way these things are distributed, it doesn't matter. People just are hungry for content and they'll consume it. And if you're a genre fan, it doesn't matter how you get it. I can't wait. I can't wait for the, I'm really terrible. I'm sorry with the titles these days. The Five Nights at Freddy's, Nicolas Cage.
Willy's Wonderland.
Yeah, Willy's Wonderland. That's next on my list. And I just saw Psycho Gorman, PG Psycho Gorman, and I just love that. But that's something that I just couldn't wait till I could get it on. It's, I think, streaming next month, but I bought it on iTunes and I was perfectly happy to watch it at home.
I've been pushing that one on these guys for a while.
Yeah, you have.
Did I answer your question?
Midsummer on me.
Did I answer your question?
You did.
Yeah, absolutely. I like what you said though about not necessarily. I think with horror, it's moved. It's not away from the mainstream, like you mentioned, The Conjuring, but there's so much good horror that's maybe not the mainstream stuff, and forever and ever, about a decade ago, I threw a Halloween party where we were just watching horror movies all day long. And I had started this thing where I was like, I just feel like you're never seeing any good horror. And then once I started investigating, I'm like, I've been so blind. There's so much good horror out there.
There's a huge amount. It's just like a tidal wave of movies in the last 5 to 10 years, I would say 5 years especially.
Oh yeah.
You know, whether it's on, you know, not a Netflix streaming service, you know, like it's out there. It's definitely out there. You know, the fact that like Creepshow could go back and, you know, come back and be supported on Shudder, you know, I think that couldn't have happened even 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, just with, you know, like you said, A24, I mean, there, it's just smart horror, you know, horror that it's not in your face like we're used to. These are movies that are actually making us think, like Get Out and Midsommar, Hereditary. These are films that are actually playing with your emotions because you're thinking about them as you're watching them, instead of, like you said, having that detached moment, just watching blood splatter across the screen.
And I think it's easy to say that when a big conglomerate, you know, is sort of taking over, it's going to dumb down the material. And there's always that threat. But there are, as for as many situations as that happens, you also have Netflix, which is its own juggernaut, but they give their folks free rein. They just say, here's a bunch of money, make a great movie, we need content. And they let the creators do their thing. And so if it's not very good, it's not necessarily Netflix's fault. And if it's really good, then, you know, they get praise for supporting it.
Well, and I think, Justin, I do want to comment on this. They, Jay, you were saying that, like, you know, for a while you were thinking, like, there's not many good horror films out. And you guys seem to have, you know, a plethora that you can list out. Definitely, obviously, The Conjuring and Insidious have been in the mainstream, but I would say, at least for me, so I was born in 82, so these movies were all very much on the forefront for me in Search of Darkness, and then obviously in the 90s, but I'd say in the 2000s, movies that I think what happened, at least for me, from my perspective, where it was like, I kind of veered away from the horror genre is, you know, The Hills Have Eyes remake, Hostel, Saw, a lot of those very intensely torturous movies came out, and those seemed to be the ones that were promoted a lot. And so I backpedaled a lot from horror, and I think just kind of stayed there. And besides Paranormal Activity and Insidious and Conjuring, and then an occasionally peppering of like The Strangers or something, I just kind of put horror out of my mind. And now you guys are reminding me, like, okay, maybe I do need to dip my toe back into some of them if those not so gory but very smart and, you know, make me feel like I've had a little bit too much to think movies are out there, then like I'm happy to dip my toe back in that pool.
Come on in,
Aaron.
Too
much to think, then too much to drink, right?
Exactly.
Come on in, Aaron. The water's fine.
So Midsommar is on your list now. Perfect.
Fine.
Oh, Midsommar is great. I love that movie.
One of my favorite movies of the last. That's probably on my favorite movie. One of my favorite movie lists. It's on the rotating list. I was blown
away. One of the most unnerving movies ever, because there's not one dark shot.
Well, see, what happens is they're going to build it up and you'll be disappointed. That's the problem with any of these. I saw Hereditary not knowing anything other than that it was Toni Collette and that it was horror. My background is, prior to doing these, I worked for Famous Monsters. And then before that, I was at Entertainment Tonight. And so it was my job day in and day out to dissect, you know, even like a trailer and the teaser of the trailer and the teaser of the teaser of the trailer and the mention of the teaser of the thought of the trailer, to the point where ad nauseum, I knew anything about everything. And by the time I got to the movie, there were zero surprises. And once I moved on from that, I made a rule for myself that I would not watch any trailers and not know anything about any movie that I knew that I wanted to watch. If I knew about it, if I was interested in it, I'm like, that's it. I'm going to cut myself off. And so Hereditary is like a perfect example of something where people were raving about it. I was like, all right, I know I want to see it. That's it. I'm not going to watch even a trailer. And spooked the absolute hell out of me. And I'm glad, you know, and I always go to the trailers afterwards, after I've seen it. And I've a sigh of relief, because I'm like, oh, they totally ruined the ending here. You know, they showed, you know, the person in flame here. That would have been a total spoiler, you know. too many spoilers. So I really enjoy the organic experience of not knowing about a film. So there you go. I hope you enjoy Midsommar, but it's already been overhyped for you.
We've already ruined it for you.
I love it when I can blame Jay and Ryan for my problem. So
that's what we're here for.
That's right.
An everyday sort of thing.
I don't have a good transition to go back in time, but you describe yourself on your website as a nostalgia curator. So I have a question. Why the 80s? Why do we find ourselves nowadays, especially drawn back to properties from the 80s? I'm looking at you, Top Gun, who just got pushed back to November. I'm looking at you, Ghostbusters Afterlife. And not just that, but also with just entertainment that takes place in the 80s. Stranger Things, the Goldbergs, you know, why are we drawn back to the 80s?
Well, the people who get to make these projects now, whether it's a TV show or whether it's a movie, they, for the most part, grew up in the 80s. They were kids or they were adolescents, and it was a great time for them. And now they get to make the movies. They get to drive the projects. And they like to be nostalgic for their childhood, and they like to set it in the 80s. And then the more that compounds on itself of, you know, success in terms of box office or viewership, the more people want to do something similar. And next thing you know, a celebration of a decade happens. You know, I grew up in the 70s when so many things were about the 50s. You know, so Happy Days, Sha Na Na, American Graffiti, all these things were celebrating the 50s and the early 60s and doing really well. And so everyone wanted to sort of do that. And even Back to the Future is a celebration of the 50s when you think about it. You know, Back to the Future, they went so far back to the future, back in time. But it was really, 30 years? Which, if you think about what 30 years was like 30 years ago, going back in time, you probably wouldn't want to go there, would you? You'd probably want to go farther back. You know, be a little more interesting. But that's kind of why. I think you could assign it to any decade, really. You know, so I think if anything, the 90s are starting to rear their head and ready to elbow out the 80s. And
we see it in the fashion.
Yeah, there's a whole generation, you know, of last Comic-Con I went to when I was able to go to Comic-Cons, you know, back in the day, in the olden days. You know, I remember there was a party in the house band. All they played was 90s tunes. And I was just like, all right, this tells me right here, right now, that's what people want now to be nostalgic about. So, yeah, the 80s are huge, but 90s are next. And, you know, there's like a 20, 25-year, maybe 30-year cycle, but it's about 25 years that all these decades really come back with a vengeance.
Yeah, that's true. I did just share. Great news, guys. JNCO jeans are coming back. So as wide as you want your pant legs, no more skinny jeans. JNCO's on the way back.
Good God.
Biggest crime, in my opinion, of the late 80s and the early 90s were acid wash jeans. That's my
I like this.
They were pretty bad.
All right. So since we're on the topic of, you know, horror greatness and the 80s, we have to ask you, and I know we're putting you on the spot again, but you went through a lot of films with these In Search of Darkness films. What is one or two movies that you think are the most influential? And then after that, what are a couple horror movies that every horror fan must be familiar with?
Evil Speak. I don't think I brought that one up yet, but, again, I cannot pick one, but I have a quartet of films that come to mind when we're talking about influential, and in no special order, or maybe I should put them in order. You know, The Shining, incredibly influential because that showed that horror could be an absolute classic by a great, you know, top level, top shelf filmmaker, and it's an adaptation of Stephen King back when. At the time when Stephen King was in vogue, you know, I'm digress a little bit, but if you follow the trajectory of Stephen King movies in the 80s, in the very beginning, you know, starting from Carrie in 76, Everyone wanted to do a Stephen King movie, and everyone said, all right, everyone get in line. You get one, and you get one, and you get one, to the point where his name was Mudd halfway through the decade, to the point where they didn't even want to make Pet Sematary. But the only reason Pet Sematary got made was because there was going to be a writer's strike, and they said, we need a script. Oh, Pet Sematary is a script that's done, and it's ready to shoot. Let's just do that. And it was turned out to be a great script and a great story. Reanimator, I think, is one of the most influential, one of the greatest films of the decade, because it showed how racy and wrong and ridiculous you could get while having an absolute sense of humor, while absolutely horrifying you, absolutely entertaining you, and managing to shock you every step of the way. Stuart Gordon's Reanimator is just an absolute classic. An American Werewolf in London, that's probably my top film of the 80s, if I'm forced to choose, if anyone is the type of person who would force me to choose a favorite film.
Aaron.
Your secret is safe with us.
But yeah, American Werewolf in London was Star Wars was an incredibly influential film. Star Wars made me head west and get into movies. It changed me from an audience member to wanting to be a movie maker. And Halloween was the first film that really scared me in a real grown-up way. But the first horror film that made me want to really know how the sausage was made was Rick Baker's work in American Werewolf in London, and the amazing agility that John Landis demonstrates in his script and his directing in balancing comedy and horror and just making it work with perfection. And that was a tremendous influence on me and so many people, especially when it came to, you know, change your head transformation effects. You know, you wouldn't have Manimal, the TV series, without American Werewolf in London. There's another dated reference, look it up. and then lastly, I'll say Nightmare on Elm Street. Wes Craven's Nightmare on Elm Street was incredibly influential. Greg Nicotero in In Search of Darkness verbalizes this perfectly. You know, by the time 84 came along, the slasher genre sort of got extremely tired and they were out of ideas. You know, it was just kind of the same thing over and over and over. And Nightmare on Elm Street showed that you could sort of bring a fantasy and phasmagoric element to the horror genre with a villain that was not tangible, but could still kill you in your dreams. And it was imaginative, it was surreal, and it showed that with great effects and solid storytelling and acting, and you know, you could still bring in a very large commercial audience and create a whole franchise based on a brand new character that you want to create and still be different and not just make a slasher subgenre pick. So those are my four.
Those are all, man, those are all too, the effects and all, at least American Werewolf and Nightmare in a lot of ways really hold up. Nightmare is one I try to watch every year in October.
Well, Reanimator, I mean.
Yeah. And Reanimator is awesome.
I mean, people are going to say, well, what about Evil Dead? I would throw in Evil Dead 2 as well. I mean, I can keep going.
Yeah.
But I've chosen four.
No, that's
good.
The
audience wants to know your exhaustive list of all the influential movies they can watch In Search of Darkness.
Well, exactly. Thank you very much.
On Shudder. You're very welcome.
And I appreciate that. You know, I'll just direct them to 9 hours. And that's pretty much from my brain. So that's my answer right there.
It's an amazing 9 hours from your brain.
Well, that's a great four choices, by the way.
Yeah.
Solid. And I'm glad that I call it the Unholy Trinity. The father, Michael Myers, the son, Jason Voorhees, and of course, the unholy ghost. So, solid call on Freddy Krueger.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to kind of ask the same question as Ryan, but instead of horror movies with 80s sci-fi movies, in honor of your upcoming project, In Search of Tomorrow, what do you think are the one or two most influential 80s sci-fi movies? That you think people need to be familiar with?
One or two, huh? You're going to limit
me. Or four. You can do four. Four or five is
Let
fine.
Let him say however many he wants, Aaron. Why do you have to limit him all the time?
You guys are constantly putting me in a box and restraining me. No, I'm happy to do this. I'm happy to do this. But I'm going to give you four as well. And also in no special order, but maybe I should do it in order of release. But I think with 80s sci-fi, there are a variety. Again, you're going into sort of subgenres and movies that straddle different genres. It's not necessarily just sci-fi in space necessarily. But one, and I think they're all pretty obvious, but the reason why they're obvious is because they are so incredibly influential and powerful. I'll start with The Empire Strikes Back. You know, Star Wars just changed the game radically, but Empire showed that you can excel with a sequel and continue an adventure and just up the ante every step of the way, and then have the balls to leave it a 3-year cliffhanger for the entire audience. it's just an amazing film and just tremendously influential. And you know, my video store experience in the 80s was constantly trying to relive my Star Wars glory, because you can only watch Star Wars and Empire so many times. And so I'd go to Star Crash, I'd go to Battle Beyond the Stars, I'd go to Galaxina and Saturn 3, whatever would be out there, you know, saying, oh, this is a Star Wars-y cover, let's check it out. And I would be constantly disappointed. And there's a reason, you know, they're all trying to be what they couldn't be, which is the greatest of the great. Tremendously influential. Now, next to that, you could think about things that were incredibly visually influential. And I would have to go straight to Blade Runner for that. Mm. You know, the production design, the story, the concept, you know, the Philip K. Dick story. But just, you know, Sid Mead, his concepts, everything that Ridley Scott put in there from, you know, a rainy Los Angeles in 2019, which was a hybrid of multicultures and, you know, heavily influenced with Asian culture, advertising culture, you know, you don't want to be here when you're not rich enough to be off world. You know, humanity is questionable at this point, and then so it really follows a bunch of replicants who want to be human and want to extend their lives, and a guy who has to, you know, get rid of them, but he may or may not be a replicant himself. You know, back then it wasn't as much of a question, more these people like to talk now that Deckard is clearly a replicant, but I like to go on whether it's a question mark or he's not, you know. He's just a lonely guy with a crappy job, but he's the only guy who's the best at it. I'm also going to go to The Road Warrior. Mm. Road Warrior, you know, Mad Max was a great action movie. The Road Warrior, again, like Empire Strikes Back, up the ante. There's an element here where we're talking about sequels. You know, the follow-up took a great idea and just went to town with it, with a bigger budget, bigger ideas, and a more assured director or vision or producing that turned this thing into something that everyone else wanted to be like. And in the wake of The Road Warrior, you had dozens and dozens of wannabe post-apocalyptic, you know, clans battling each other with vehicles and roller skates, solar babies and things like that. Check that one up. You got to look for solar babies. That one's awful too. But that's definitely inspired by The Road Warrior. And then lastly, I'm just going to put Aliens in there as well. Again, such a great film. You know, Terminator is such an amazing film and incredibly influential. But if I had to pick one James Cameron film, it's definitely Aliens, showing that all you need to do is add an S to the title and then be true to it and exceed it. and straddle the action genre, the sci-fi genre, the horror genre to be a unique badass film that has multiple endings, that also is the ultimate mother-daughter film. Mm-hmm. You know, because that movie is nothing without the heart of Ripley and Newt and the reason of her going back in the first place and then finding a reason to stay. So it's such a great film. Those are pretty influential.
We're all on a main thread for the front row, and one of our co-hosts just finished watching Aliens, so he's having the discussion with himself, and of course we're chiming in. Does he watch 3 and 4? And of course we're like, it's mindless fun. Have fun with it. But yes, we've done Aliens on Flashbacks, and it's so much fun. It's such a good movie.
Yeah, and we're covering Road Warrior later this year too.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
I don't know about these two, but I've actually read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? So,
uh-huh. There you go.
What is
one of my
reading?
Favorite books?
What is reading?
There you go. Well, that's great. That's cool. You read. I'm impressed. Not surprised. Impressed. Just these days.
You had her swooning. You're mentioning Philip K. Dick and movies with Bill Paxton. So
there you go.
I'm equally as impressed.
Well, David, on behalf of Front Row Flashbacks, I want to offer a huge thank you for giving us not only your time, but your insights, especially on these very particular portions of cinematic awesomeness, you know, 80s horror and sci-fi, which is here at Front Row Flashbacks, it's kind of what we revel in. But what I want to ask you, what can our listeners do to help or participate in the process of getting In Search of Tomorrow, you know, over that final stretch? How can
they? Yeah, thanks. Well, I appreciate you guys having me over to chat about this stuff. Right now, I'm in the middle of production for In Search of Tomorrow. We're aiming to get this out and done at the end of the year in December. Right now, we're doing an Indiegogo where you could pre-order the film. If you go to 80sscifidoc.com, which is 80s, 80sscifi doc, go there, and it's all on, you know, our socials, you know, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And you could see a variety of packages of what we offer. But ultimately, what's really cool about it is that you get your name in the credits. You get lots of cool set, you know, swag, whether it's, you know, enamel pin or posters and soundtrack and movie download, that kind of stuff. But what also is very cool is that we have this online community, Discord community, where you can get together with like-minded fans like yourself and talk about the stuff, you know, 24/7. We watch parties every week, and we have Q&As and that kind of stuff like that. So there's always stuff, and it's a very positive and reinforcing community that you could share with and not feel judged by. And that's super cool. But, like I said, 75 people being interviewed for In Search of Tomorrow. So a lot of great names of actors and filmmakers and experts and craftspeople. And it's an absolute joy for me to be able to be doing it right now. And I'm in the middle of it. I'm in the thick of it. And I get to sit down with all my heroes, you know, and pick their brains for extended period of time. And it's a dream come true for me. So In Search of Tomorrow, that's what I'm working on now. In Search of Darkness, part one is on Shudder as we speak. And In Search of Darkness 2 is coming out on the 26th on Shudder. So you can check it out. And In Search of Darkness 3, down the road, if you go to 80shorrordoc.com, 80s, 80shorrordoc.com, sign up for the newsletter, and then you can find out all the details on when we're going to be offering physical copies next and when we're going to be ramping up for In Search of Darkness 3, all that fun stuff. So those are the two URLs, 80shorrordoc.com and 80sscifidoc.
Perfect. And I will make sure those are in the show notes. So anybody interested, look in the show notes. Follow that link. I just became a Flash Gordon level sponsor. I'm going to call myself a producer. It makes me feel more important. No, I just signed up. So get on there. If you have some bucks to spare, I'm telling you, first of all, all it's going to take you is go watch In Search of Darkness on Shudder. You're going to get a half an hour in and you're going to go, I want to support whatever this dude they just interviewed is doing. So check it out. There's also a trailer for In Search of Tomorrow that they can watch on that link. It's got some stuff on there to give them some insights.
So. The new trailer doing it gives a taste of what's to come.
I thought we weren't supposed to watch trailers.
Touché.
Once again, huge thank you to a true master of nostalgia. His horror and sci-fi knowledge were vast. Mr. David Wenger, thank you, sir. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you for all your work.
Thank you, guys. And I appreciate you spreading the good word.
Okay, guys. I had a complete and thorough blast talking with David Wenger. Dude has a vast, far more vast than we do, of knowledge on not just horror and sci-fi, but that's what we focused on. And man, did I love it. What did you guys think? How do you think the interview went? What did you get from it, Aaron?
He's just a lovely gentleman. You know, I think that you think when you're talking to a director of a film or a documentary that they might be kind of like elitist, especially this is somebody who studied film, like this is his whole career, and like not elitist at all. Just like super easy to talk to, brings so much knowledge and insight to the table, but doesn't make you feel inadequate for his breadth of knowledge. Just like the documentary, like just bringing you along with for the ride. So I loved talking to him. And hopefully look forward to if we get to interview him again in the future or screen some of his other documentaries. That'd be amazing.
Yeah, it'd be hopefully we can get with him on In Search of Tomorrow, his sci-fi version, same kind of documentary style. But hopefully we can talk about that, and hopefully we can pull him on to be a guest host with us on an episode. That'd be great. Ryan, what about you? What'd you think? What'd you get out of it?
This is a guy that I could probably sit in a room with and just shoot the breeze and talk movies with. His knowledge was vast, and we barely just nicked the surface. This guy knows what he does, and as a journalist, you know, he is very well versed in what it means to make sure you're doing your background, your research, and it's not just that, and especially with this interview, it shows in his work. You know, you get that in the fact of In Search of Darkness and the fact that it's 4 hours. This is something that's very well thought out, very well researched, and his interviews in the film are fantastic. And he just comes across as someone that just loves film, and we got that with this interview. And when that passion shows, you know, it's just very easy to talk to someone because it just feels very natural. So I can just see him interviewing all the stars from the 80s of these films, and just how easy it was just to talk about all the films that they address in his In Search of series. You know, great guy. Look forward to maybe talking to him again.
Yeah, that was, man. That was a really good time. and like the people he got to talk to, man.
It was just, oh, yeah.
Crazy.
All for sure.
Horror and, legends. You know? Yeah. Movie legends, film legends. It's pretty rad stuff. So,
I was just going to say, like I had told him, but in... You know, one of the things that like Ryan talks about when we get into awards season, it's all about like, hey, I look at film as an art form. And there are so many aspects that go into creating this work of art. And David just has an amazing way, not only in the way he talks in the interview, but also conveys in his film that he's showing you all of these lesser thought about pieces of the puzzle, like to create art. And I love that he takes horror, which is usually kind of like nose up, you know, looked down upon as a genre as far as art goes in film, and kind of turns that stigma on its head and really gets into all of these pieces. I mean, like... Special effects would be nowhere, obviously, without, I'm blanking on ILM's, Industrial Light and Magic, you know, in Star Wars, but also without horror, without the horror genre, like where would we be without special effects advancements before everything could just be done by CGI? And he shows that in his film. It's incredible.
Yeah. And it's, It's great being a horror fan, mentioning those things, just hearing the names Baker, Savini, these guys who
Nicotero.
Nicotero, these guys who just like were like weird horror engineers, essentially, who just made this gnarly stuff and added to that decade of movies. And yeah, I think you're right. This is a genre that unfortunately gets frowned upon. Not us. We here at Front Row Flashbacks, we live in the pulp. We live in the kitsch, Brandon Davis, and AKA the fun stuff. So yeah, and horror is one of those things. Kind of reminds me of like certain music styles, like punk rock. Like, oh, it's just like really fast. Yeah, if there's a message, right? A lot of times with horror, there's usually something there. It's usually an allegory. It's usually has much broader themes than what looks at the surface level. And he touches on that, but then also touches on the stuff that's happening in those movies. Man, if you are into horror, you're already on Shudder. Check out In Search of Darkness. And here in just a week or so after we release this, In Search of Darkness 2 is going up on there. And I can't wait. Ryan, you got something on the tip of your tongue?
I was just going to say, you know, it's funny that Aaron brought up the Oscars, because the Oscars in the horror movie are completely opposite. You know, it's like we said in the interview, there's hardly a movie that gets a horror movie that gets Oscar love, you know, whether it be The Exorcist in the 70s or Silence of the Lambs, which will drop soon here too as well in the 90s. But like we said before the interview started, you don't really call the Silence of the Lambs horror. It's more of a thriller. So, I mean, it's just, it's my cup of tea. Horror is my genre. It is my go-to thing. And just having someone like David come on and just talk to you about it like it's so it just made me feel right at home.
Made you feel normal.
And anyone who's worried about the, you know, it's a 4.5-hour documentary, but if you're worried about the length, it feels way faster than Nomadland.
Shut up!
Nomadland.
It also feels faster than The Irishman. And I loved The Irishman. And I love Ryan.
Thank you. Oh, I'll see you all Sunday when we do
it. All right, weirdos. I think we need to wrap up. That was a great interview. And for all of us here in the Front Row Flashbacks, we'll see you in the front row.